Hari Ball, Hari Ball, Hari Ball, Nittai go to Hari Ball. Jaya Jaya Prabhupada, 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 Prabhupada. Jayam Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parivaraja Kacharya Rasta Tara Sata Sisri Man. His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Sri Sri Gaunitai Ki Jai. Sri Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Devi Ki Jai. Sri Sri Rukmini Dwarkadish Ki Jai. Gaur Premanandi. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. Gaur Premanandi. Hare Krishna. So this is the last session. I'll be leaving tomorrow morning. Last night we had discussed about the objections of some to Prabhupada's establishment of a standard of 16 rounds. And I mentioned that now this evening we'll talk about a couple of devotees that were given permission to chant more than 16 rounds. And what happened? So Prabhupada had gone to Mayapur on January the 17th, 1976. He spent just over 2 months there. He'd gone for the Gopurnima festival. And he met with one devotee. His name was Sharmadas. So he was an African-American devotee who had gone to Africa to preach there. And then sometime in mid to late 1975, he got very disturbed by the, I don't know what was going on in the African Yatra, but there were some disturbances. Things were not well there. Brahmananda Maharaj was the GBC at that time, but he was traveling with Srila Prabhupada. So he wasn't there to oversee things, and somehow or another things began to get a little fractious and disruptive. So Sharma was a bit disturbed by that, and he turned up in Vrindavan when Prabhupada was there during the Janmashtami visit in 75, and then he got permission from Srila Prabhupada to go to Mayapur and just chant. So now it's early 76, Prabhupada himself is in Mayapur. This was on February the 25th. So the conversation turned to Sharmadas, an American devotee who came here after serving in Africa. Disturbed by the misbehavior and poor standards there, he came to Vrindavan to see Srila Prabhupada late last year, saying he only wanted to chant Hare Krishna. Prabhupada allowed him to come here to Mayapur. At present, he's living in the Goshala, chanting 150 rounds a day and eating only the remnants of foodstuffs left by the devotees. Recently, he came to see Srila Prabhupada to get permission to build a tree hut to live in so that he could avoid seeing anyone. He complained that he was being disturbed because devotees were coming to see him and interrupting his chanting. But Prabhupada condemned his idea, which he said was living like a monkey. He said that Sharma's so-called renunciation was actually only another form of sense gratification. It was also based on selfish interest, even if it was only a little display of it. Prabhupada gave the example of two thieves, one who steals a diamond and the other who steals a cucumber. Prabhupada explained that simply because one steals in a small way, it does not mean that he is not a thief. Jaipataka Swami asked if Grihastha life was meant for the one who steals cucumbers. Prabhupada laughed. He said, yes, Krishna is giving allowance for stealing cucumber. Prabhupada conceded that Sharma, at least, wasn't doing anything bad, but he said that active service is better. Prabhupada was not displeased with him, as something is better than nothing. He allowed him to stay here Because if he leaves, he may end up going elsewhere and practice something other than Krishna consciousness. So that was February the 25th. Then on March the 8th, Sharma actually came over from his hideaway at the Gaushala in the afternoon to see Srila Prabhupada during the Darshan period. And he had a request that now he wanted to leave Mayapur. He wants to go and chant at Radhakund. With so many devotees here now for the festival, he complained that he is again being disturbed in his chanting. Prabhupada told him that this indicated that his mind was restless. Previously, he had asked to live in a tree, and now Radhakund. You are not fit for Nirjana Bhajan, Prabhupada told him. This is for the Mahabhagwats, like Haridas Thakur, who were completely undisturbed. Haridas Thakur lived in a cave with a large snake, but he was not perturbed. He added that if one's mind is even a little disturbed, Nirjana Bhajan will not be possible. After this meeting, Sharma Prabhu later told Pushtakrishna Swami, who had just become Prabhupada's secretary, and he had been preaching in South Africa. So he told Pushtakrishna Swami that he had decided to return to Africa and preach. And Prabhupada was pleased to hear this. So that was all we heard of Sharma for a while. And then later in the year, on September the 27th, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, and he received a letter from Sharma. So he had been there, I guess, about 6 months in Africa. And then again, now he was becoming a bit disturbed. So he sent a letter from Nairobi, and he again requested permission to make chanting his main service, saying that he didn't want to act whimsically and that he only wanted to please Srila Prabhupada. He declared, "We have no love for Krishna, but we have this attraction to serve Krishna as a servant of the confidential serving maids of Krishna. By your mercy, we understand that we cannot go to Vrindavan by any ticket. So we are, by the grace of Krishna, trying to fix our mind on this service in Vrindavan. This fixing of the mind is dependent on my chanting of Krishna's names, and my chanting Krishna names is dependent on your mercy, because my god brothers do not like me chanting. We do not want to commit any offenses to our god brothers, yet sometimes when I tell them that I only want to hear about Krishna in Vrindavan, or the glories of his holy name or qualities, some of them say that we must talk of other things. They are more pure than my sinful self. As far as this living entity, he only wants to hear or talk of Krishna. My god brothers, as far as I am concerned, are better and more advanced. But because of my sinful condition, if you would allow me to chant these few extra rounds, read your books and render some small service, maybe before leaving this body, Krishna will allow this sinful living entity to be elevated to the position of one of his loving servants. It is our only desire to have our devotional Kripa take shelter of Goloka Vrindavan and to somehow or another please our spiritual master and Krishna." Srila Prabhupada's reply to him was quite terse. "So, why did you leave Mayapur if you were so expert in chanting? Read my books and do some menial service. But why have you left Mayapur? You were restless, so what can be done? You were chanting in Mayapur. But wherever you may live, you have to abide by the order of the authority. Because you were restless, you are not fit for chanting absolutely." And that was the last that we heard, actually. That's the last I ever heard, anyway, of Sharma. I don't know if anybody here knows of his whereabouts or what happened to him. But that was it. I believe he left the African Yatra and that just disappeared. But it's an interesting letter. That what he's saying there was that, you know, he wants to meditate on Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan, and then that's a very specific practice that either very advanced Siddha Purusha devotees do, or a lot of the Babajis in Vrindavan, they do that also. This Astakalya Leela, meditating on different kinds of pastimes of Krishna according to the time of the day. But that's for very, very advanced devotees, but sometimes that gets put around that this is actually the real practice of Krishna consciousness. So somehow or another he had gotten this influence, and that's actually, if you understand what he's saying in his letter there, he's talking about he wants to meditate on, you know, serving the maid servants of Krishna. He wants to get into the Gopi Leelas. And then Prabhupada's reply was very frank. You are not fit for chanting, absolutely. Better you preach, that's all. Get purified that way. So that was one devotee who was attempting to chant more rounds. I don't know what happened to him. There was another devotee who had also been given permission to go to Mayapur and make chanting his only service. In 1975, this devotee, I think his name was Odalami, he had been diagnosed by a doctor that he only had a few months to live. So he went to Srila Prabhupada and he pressured him that I'm not going to live very much longer. I just want to chant, purify myself and go to Mayapur and stay there until I die. So he was asking, I want to get Babaji initiation so that I can do that. So Prabhupada reluctantly actually initiated him as a Babaji, and I think he was the only person of Prabhupada's disciples that got Babaji initiation. So that was in, I think that initiation was July 5th, 1975, here in America. So off he went to Mayapur. So then again, Prabhupada in early 76, February, we were there in Mayapur. So on February the 4th, then Prabhupada had been making some inquiries, where is Odalami? And he wasn't there. So Prabhupada mentioned Odalami, who had been told by doctors that he would die within a few months and had asked to be given Babaji initiation. Prabhupada reluctantly agreed. And this Odalami Maharaj came to spend his last days in Mayapur chanting Hare Krishna. But when another doctor informed him that he would not die so soon, he returned to his wife in the USA, gave up devotional service, and became like a kami again. He was last seen surfing on the West Coast. So that proves Prabhupada's point, that unless you're actually on this, you know, very advanced platform, Nirjana Bhajan is simply not possible. And the result will be that you sit down and chant, but you'll think of all your material activities, as Prabhupada said, money and women, and then you fall down. So it's better to work according to your realization, do your sadhana very nicely, and then by hard work and preaching, gradually you'll become qualified to chant the Hare Krishna mantra continuously. But you can't artificially jump onto that platform, even on the threat of death. Of course, we're all going to die very soon anyway. You know, from a cosmic point of view, we're all going to die in a few seconds or even less. So that's not necessarily an impetus. The real impetus is that you actually have to have a taste for the holy name, and that has to exceed your taste for material pleasures. And if it doesn't, then when you're chanting, instead of thinking of Krishna, you'll start thinking of all material things. You'll make offenses, and then you'll fall down. So that's what happened there. So on this point then, Prabhupada did sometimes talk quite a lot about, you know, the qualifications for chanting. And there was an interesting conversation that he had when we were visiting Aligarh on October the 9th in 1976. Prabhupada had gone to the house of Mr. Surendra Kumar Saigal. He owned a big company called the Tiger Lock Company. They make all these brass locks and things. It's all over India. So Aligarh is only 1 hour away from Vrindavan. And at the end of March in 76, in between the Mayapur and Vrindavan sections of the Gopurnima festival, we'd had a one-day pandal in Aligarh that Mr. Saigal had organized. So now in October, he had invited Prabhupada to come for 2 days and stay at his house. And he invited all the leading citizens of Aligarh to come and hear Srila Prabhupada speak on the Bhagavad Gita. So it was a nice 2-day session. So on the first day in the afternoon, Prabhupada went out onto the lawn. He had a very big property, about 2 or 3 acres, and an old colonial style house. And Prabhupada was talking about different things. So was chatting with his audience, and he was telling us, he said that everybody can be raised to the platform of Krishna consciousness. There's no difficulty. That is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. So from early in the morning, he is teaching Udila Aruna Puravabhagi Dwijamani Goda Amani Jagi. When the rising sun appeared in the east, the jewel of the twice born, Lord Gaurasundara, awakened. He was not lazy. He was busy from early in the morning. So if we at least pretend to follow Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we cannot sleep. We must rise early in the morning. One must get up 1.5 hours before the sunrise. That is Mangalarati. Mangalarati means to get up early in the morning, take your bath, and be prepared for the Mangalarati. And then begin your chanting, prayer. This is activity. Prabhupada told us about an exchange that he had had with a man in the 1940s who had challenged him that Vaishnavas were lazy fellows. He chuckled as he recounted the conversation. So I said, "You have never seen a Vaishnav." "No, I have seen these Vaishnavs. They do not do anything, and taking mala and pretending to be very highly elevated and sleep and snore." "But you have not seen. You might have seen these pseudo Vaishnavs, but real Vaishnav you have not seen." "Oh, what is that real Vaishnav?" And I said that in India there were two big wars. One war was the Ram Ravan, and the other war, Kurukshetra. So in these two wars, the hero is a Vaishnav. One is Hanuman, and the other is Arjuna. "Have you seen them? Have you heard about them? Are they lazy fellows?" "Hanuman is a Vaishnav. He could raise one mountain and jump over the sea and set fire to the very beautiful state of Ravan. This is a Vaishnav." "And Arjuna, he was in the beginning hesitating. 'Oh, my cousin brothers, they're on the other side.' And then he decided, 'Yes, I shall fight.' Krishna inquired from him, 'Now I have instructed you. Now whatever you like, you can do. And what is your decision?' And then he clearly said, 'Yes, my decision is there. I will fight. Karishye vachanam tava. As you advise, I can understand that you want this fighting.' So Vaishnav means for the sake of Krishna, he can do anything. Not that he is a lazy fellow, showing, 'Oh, I have become a very big Vaishnav. Let me sleep under the name of chanting Hare Krishna.' Faithful servant means always alert. And that is bhakti. Anulkul yena krishnanu shilanam bhakti uttama. Simply one has to execute anulkul yena, how Krishna is satisfied. And this is bhakti. Prabhupada stressed that neither Hanuman, a monkey, nor Arjuna, a warrior, were told by the Lord to give up their occupational duties to sleep and snore and become a great devotee. No, he never says that, Prabhupada stressed. He says, "Oh, you're attached to this kind of work? All right, do it. But the result that you give to me, that is bhakti. Arjuna, you're a military man. All right, I ask you to fight. You become a fighter and become my devotee. Bhaktosi priyosi me." Just see. What is that? He was not chanting Hare Krishna. But Krishna says, "Bhaktosi priyosi me. You are very dear friend and my devotee." Prabhupada made it clear that he wasn't speaking against sitting down and chanting. But one has to be qualified to do that. "Of course," he said, "the ultimate is to be always absorbed in glorifying the Lord. But not in the beginning. In the beginning you must work very hard. You come to the stage of pure devotional platform. Then you can fully engage yourself in meditation or chanting. But not in the beginning. In the beginning, you should be very expert and active. That is wanted. That is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's. Udilo. From early in the morning, active. Come on, chant. Come with me so that others will see. If we make a party chanting Hare Krishna, so in the beginning they may be disturbed because they have become accustomed to sleep until 9 o'clock. But as they will hear, then gradually they will become purified and they will receive it." So that was a nice story that Prabhupada told there about this man. So even in the 1940s, you know, before the mass multimedia age, still the Vaishnavas were being criticized. People knew, you go to Vrindavan, all these lazy men, they go there, they beg, and they make a show of chanting, but their only business is simply filling their bellies and sleeping. That reputation was there. And Prabhupada was very much aware of it, because he lived in Vrindavan for a number of years and he knew what was going on there. But there are some that are actually genuine chanters, and that's a very advanced platform. So Prabhupada's advice was, in the beginning, you must be very active and expert. And then you come to that stage. Again, on April the 8th, 1976, Prabhupada was giving a class in Vrindavan. And he told us what is required if we want to please Krishna and get his blessings. We have to surrender. That will please Krishna. And without pleasing him, you cannot see Krishna. You've got your eyes, big, big eyes, but you cannot see Krishna. You have to please him. And that pleasing activity is bhakti. Without that bhakti, it means sitting down silently. No, I am chanting. I do not want to go out. I am busy. So this means excuse. What will you chant? You will think of money and women, that's all. Just work. Go and sell books and work hard. That is wanted. Therefore, we do not give that opportunity. My Guru Maharaj did not give this opportunity, and we are following the same principle. No opportunity of sitting idle. No, you must work, and that will rectify. Yes. There was another time when Prabhupada went to, when we first arrived in Mayapur in mid-January of 76, then the next morning on the 18th, Prabhupada took a tour of the property. And he went over. Of course, in those days, there wasn't too many buildings. We had the front wall, and then there was the lotus building, and there was the big kitchen, and that was it. The long building wasn't built at that time. And, you know, that was all there was. So Prabhupada took a tour, and he went over to the big kitchen, and he saw some dirt on the steps leading up into the big kitchen. So then Prabhupada got really annoyed. And he said, "What is this? What is this dirt?" He said, "For 300 years, it's never been cleaned." So then Jabhidhaka Maharaj, he said, "Well, it's very difficult to get the devotees to clean in the morning because they want to do their japa." So Prabhupada said, "In the name of japa, they are simply sleeping." He said, "First clean, then make japa." He said, "In the name of japing, they are simply sleeping." He said, "This is not a free hotel. Don't make it a free hotel." He said, "Everybody that comes, they must work very hard." So he was very strict about that. He didn't want people to just come and make a show and then take advantage. So that's a few things about chanting 16 rounds, or chanting more than 16 rounds. Any questions up to this point? Okay. Well, Prabhupada often mentioned 2 hours as being, you know, like an ideal time. Within 2 hours, you should be able to get your rounds done. I think Prabhupada chanted a little bit faster than that. Yeah, maybe about an hour and a half or an hour and 40 minutes. But he said 2 hours was about the right. Maybe. That's pretty fast chanting, 5 minutes. But 2 hours means what? 8 rounds an hour. So that's 7.5 minutes a round. That's not bad. I take a bit longer than that, but I know some devotees that are quicker. The main thing is that you chant clearly and you hear it. You hear the holy names. Whether it takes an hour or, 5 hours. But you have to chant clearly so you can hear the names properly. You have somebody here? Yeah? No? Well, there were lots that were disappearing that were chanting less as well. You know, more or less, but the point is the quality has to be there. Yeah? And Prabhupada said, stress many times, 16 rounds is minimum. If you can chant more, then that's welcome. But at least you have to do your 16 rounds. And there was actually a standard when we did chant more than 16 rounds, at least twice a month. So that's the next point, was that February the 11th, 1976, we were on a morning walk in Mayapur. Tamal Krishna Maharaj asked about chanting while observing Ekadasi. He said, we should always chant 25 rounds on Ekadasi if initiated. And that was the standard, at least when I joined, we were told. Every Ekadasi you chant 25 rounds. And we always did that without fail. So Prabhupada said, initiated? Everyone. Why initiated? So that should be the standard for our movement for Ekadasi Day, Tamal asked. Standard is 16, Prabhupada said, but if one can chant more, then he is welcome. Tamal Krishna pressed to know if 25 was mandatory or not. When Jayapataka Maharaj suggested that it was recommended, Prabhupada seemed to disagree. No, Ekadasi means that, fasting and chanting. However, when Tamal Krishna Maharaj referred to his men going out in book distribution, Srila Prabhupada was quick to clarify. No, no, that is also preaching work, so for that purpose you can stop this. But generally, if he has no preaching work, then he can chant extra. So as far as I understood, that was the standard that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta had also. That the devotees that were staying in the temples, they had to do 64 rounds. They had to chant extra on Ekadasi, like that. But the devotees that were being sent out preaching, then they were allowed to do less because they were busily engaged in doing their preaching work. So there was kind of like a varying standard according to what the devotees were doing. So Prabhupada had mentioned there about sitting and sleeping. And of course that's also, you know, in our ISKCON temples you often see that. Devotees, you know, they start chanting and then they start nodding off. And not long after I joined Prabhupada's party, he caught me out on that one. We were in Bombay. This was on December 19th, 1975. So I'd been on the party about 3 weeks at that point. And Prabhupada's quarters were at the back of Hare Krishna land. When Prabhupada first bought that land, there were 6 apartment buildings of 2 stories each. But they were all occupied. There were tenants in every one. So there was nowhere for the devotees to stay. In India, tenants have practically, you know, unassailable rights. So if somebody buys land and there are tenants on it, the tenants stay, you can't get them off. You have to wait until their tenancies run out and then, you know, get them out if you can. So all these buildings were all occupied. So what Prabhupada did was he had an extra floor built on the top of the 6 existing buildings. And then the devotees were staying in there. So one of those buildings at the back, the top floor was reserved for Srila Prabhupada on one side. And then there were 2 flats. One was for Prabhupada and one was for his servants. They weren't big, quite small. And the layout was that when you went into Prabhupada's quarters, there was one small room. That was like a little reception. And in that room, there was a toilet, that was an enclosed toilet, and there was a sink on the outside of that, so the sink was in the room. And then going off from that room, there was the darshan room, and then at the back there was a kitchen and there was a bedroom. So I used to come in to Prabhupada's room early in the morning. We didn't sleep in Prabhupada's rooms, but I'd come in about 4 o'clock or 4:30, and then I'd sit in that reception room and wait for Srila Prabhupada to come out from his translation work, and then he would come out and brush his teeth in the sink and wash and everything and get ready for the morning walk. So this particular morning, I was sitting in the little room there. Prabhupada came out and I didn't see him because I was, my head was down, I was out. So Prabhupada made a noise and, you know, then I woke up. So I offered my obeisances. Prabhupada looked at me. He wasn't angry, but he said, do not sit while chanting. He said, sitting means sleeping. So that was it. After that, I always stood up. But it was a little difficult sometimes when you were traveling with Prabhupada to chant your rounds nicely. I used to like to chant loud enough, you know, so I could hear it properly. But you couldn't chant loudly when you were around Srila Prabhupada, because it would disturb him. So he had to chant almost silently, and I just found that a little difficult to get adjusted to. There were a couple of incidences. One time I was told about a devotee that had come, I guess, to the Mayapur festival. This was before I joined the party. And Prabhupada's rooms were on the third floor of the Lotus building, and that building has a veranda that goes all the way around. Prabhupada designed that building himself, actually. He liked it very much because of the space, the very, very wide verandas. So this devotee was going around Prabhupada's floor chanting his japa. And after a few minutes, Prabhupada sent his servant out. It might have been Shrutakirti, I'd have to confirm it with him, to tell this boy to stop. So apparently the boy got quite kind of put out. It seems like he thought that Prabhupada should have appreciated the fact that he was chanting Hare Krishna. And he apparently said something. And so the servant told him, he said, Prabhupada likes to hear the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. He just doesn't like to hear your offenses. So he was sent down onto another floor. And I know that previously Nanda Kumar, when he was Prabhupada's servant, he had stopped chanting his rounds. And that was reported to Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, what can I do? He's a Brahmin. If he doesn't know that he has to chant his rounds, then what can I say? So, you know, Nanda Kumar, of course, had a lot of problems because he wasn't chanting. And there were other, you know, even when I was with Prabhupada, one of the secretaries wasn't chanting his rounds. And he also had a lot of problems and ended up leaving the party and then falling down. So, you know, you had to chant your rounds, that's a fact. But you had to do it in such a way that you didn't disturb Srila Prabhupada at the same time. So it was a trick that you had to learn. But there was one time I got caught out on that one, sleeping, you know, whilst I was chanting, sitting and sleeping. There was another time, not long after that, when we were in Mayapur, and I managed to keep myself awake by chanting. And that was during Prabhupada's evening massage. So he used to take a glass of milk about 9:30 or so every evening. And then he would take rest by about 10 o'clock. And in Mayapur, in the evening time, the pujaris would come around and they would have this big clay bowl full of frankincense and they'd have a fan. And there was one devotee, his name was Anantaram Shastri. So he was an Indian devotee. He was very qualified. He was an actual Shastri. He knew Sanskrit fluently. He could speak in Sanskrit. And he could quote practically any verse, you know, from the Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam. He just mentioned something and he would give the verse. So he was very expert. And he was also very expert in rituals. So when we'd first arrived in Mayapur, we were all sitting in Prabhupada's room. Bhavananda was there and I think Jayapataka and a couple of others. Madhavisa was there. And we were chatting with Prabhupada and it came to dusk. And then we heard this kind of trumpeting noise, a conch shell blowing, and the very loud chanting of mantras. And then gradually it got nearer and nearer. And Bhavananda left. He explained to Srila Prabhupada, he said, that's Anantaram Shastri. Every evening he goes around all the floors and he chants, he blows the conch shell, and he chants all these mantras to keep all the subtle beings away. So, because at dusk, that's when all the ghosts come out. So, Shastri appeared at the doorway there, and he had this unique ability. I mean, he was the only person I ever saw that could do this. He was able to breathe in through his nose and blow out through his mouth at the same time. So, he could blow a conch shell and keep it going for like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, as long as he wanted. You know, he'd just keep sucking and blowing and sucking and blowing. But I was told recently that saxophone players, they do the same thing. They blow and they breathe it in through their nose and blow out at the same time. Anyway, he had this ability to do this. So he would come in every night and then he had this big clay bowl and he'd fan this frankincense and the whole room, the bedroom and Prabhupada's darshan room would be completely filled with frankincense smoke. You couldn't practically see anything. It was like being in a thick fog. that was to kind of drive out, you know, the mosquitoes and everything. Anyway, the point was that in the evening, when Prabhupada took rest, this was about 10 o'clock, there was still like a heavy kind of scented atmosphere. And we'd burn these mosquito coils, and they give off a very thick kind of acrid smoke. So we'd have one of those burning in the bedroom underneath Prabhupada's bed, so the smoke would come up and keep the mozzies away. And there was this devotee, Anakadundabi, he was a British devotee. He was about 2 meters tall, really big guy. So he would come in whilst Prabhupada was taking his milk in the darshan room, and he would set up this very large mosquito net that covered the whole bed. It was like a small tent. So he'd set that up, and then when he came back out, then Prabhupada would go in, and he would take rest. So in the evenings, Prabhupada took a massage. The first day that I was trained up by Upendra, how to do the massages in Delhi in 75, he had told me, now you come back at 9 o'clock, and Prabhupada has this evening massage. And I, up until that point, I'd never been aware that he had 2 massages a day. Anyway, so in the evening I went there, and then about 9:30 or so, Prabhupada stood up, went in the bedroom, and laid down on the bed. Upendra signaled for me to come in behind him. And then he showed me how to do the evening massage. So the noon massage, that was a full body with sandalwood and mustard oil. But the evening massage, that was a dry massage. Prabhupada would, you know, still have his lungi and kurta on, and you just massage through his dhoti. And it was just from the hips downwards. So I'd do his hips, thighs, calves, and feet. So that first night, it took about 10 minutes. And Upendra had told me, whilst he was massaging, he said, if Prabhupada goes to sleep, you have to keep on going. He said, the first time I did this, I was massaging, and then Prabhupada fell asleep, and he was snoring a little bit. So I thought, oh, Prabhupada's gone to sleep, I'll stop now. So he said, I was just going out, I just got to the door, and then Prabhupada's voice came out from the darkness, oh, you were finished? So he said, I had to go back and keep on going till Prabhupada told me. So he said, even if Prabhupada falls asleep, you have to keep on going until he wakes up and tells you you can go. Anyway, so it was 10 minutes, and I was thinking, well, you know, that's a really easy service. Yeah, 10 minutes finished, you're out, no problem. But it actually became the most difficult service of all later on, because it gradually crept up to about an average of half an hour or 45 minutes. But when we got to Mayapur, it was going longer and longer and longer. So on March the 1st, 1976, the evening massage has become the most difficult service to perform. It's been getting increasingly longer each night. Every evening after the pujaris fumigate Prabhupada's bedroom with incense to drive out the mosquitoes, and Nakadundabi Das and I drape a large net around the bed. When Prabhupada lays down to take rest at about 10 p.m., the lights go out. I slip under the net and sit and perch cross-legged at Prabhupada's side to massage up and down his legs and feet as he softly slumbers. Previously, the massage lasted between half an hour and 45 minutes, but here in Mayapur, the sessions have been going on for an hour or longer. Tonight, it went on for over two hours, the longest ever, and I left Prabhupada's room just after midnight. I find it very difficult to sit in the dark, sweating under the mosquito net, breathing air thick with incense smoke, and no breeze for any relief, with not a sound save Srila Prabhupada's soft snoring. It's very difficult to stay awake on the job. Occasionally, I do drift off, only to snap suddenly back to consciousness without knowing how long I've been out. So you'd be massaging, and Prabhupada would, you know, drift off to sleep, and then you'd be massaging, you get the nods. And then, you know, you'd go out, and then all of a sudden you'd jump back into consciousness again, and you wouldn't know whether you'd been out for 2 minutes or, you know, 10 minutes or 20 minutes. Who knows? And then you just keep on going. So anyway, this particular night, I just decided I'm going to make a real effort to stay awake. So tonight, by Krishna's grace, I was able to stay awake by chanting slokas within my mind. I remembered that in the Gita, Krishna called Arjuna Gudikesh, which means conqueror of sleep. So my little experience is giving me a glimpse of what a high degree of sense control is required to earn that title of Gudikesh. So I managed to stay awake the whole 2 hours. Those days I used to know a few slokas, maybe about 150 or 200. So I just kept on chanting them the whole time and I stayed awake. But it was the only time that I was able to do that, actually. Anyway, chanting's a good way to try to do that. Okay, so that's some aspects of chanting, japa, etc. Yeah. Well, it depends. If you can stay awake and sit down, that's fine. But if you get the nods, I remember that was a feature of early ISKCON temples. Our temple commander in Sydney, when I joined, that was one of his functions, was to go around during the japa period and hit people over the head with his bead bag if they were falling asleep. So they'd get the nods and he'd walk past him, whack, he'd hit you with his bead bag. And you'd wake up. If you can stay awake whilst you're sitting, that's fine. No problem. Okay, so another aspect of chanting, that was a managerial principle also. Prabhupada was always insistent that if anybody took responsibility in the movement, then they had to be up to a certain standard. One example of that was... when we got a letter from Fiji, Madhadvisa was the GBC at that time in Australia and Fiji. So on January the 7th, he had sent a letter explaining that there were some problems there and wanted some advice from Srila Prabhupada. So the society in Fiji was being organized by one family, actually, the Punjas. And this man, Dayoji Punja, they had seen some of Prabhupada's disciples. They got very enthusiastic to have a temple in Fiji. They were actually the richest family in the whole island. So they invited Prabhupada to come. I think he went there in 75, and again, we went there in 76. So at the beginning of 76, Madhadvisa had gone there, and he was explaining to Prabhupada by mail about some problems. So Madhadvisa said that in legally registering ISKCON, he wanted to make sure that all the trustees are conforming to Srila Prabhupada's standards, following the regulative principles and chanting 16 rounds daily. Mr. Punja is adhering to the principles, but one or two of the other present trustees are not, although they are very favorable and have given large donations. He requested Prabhupada to ask them personally to stand down in favor of Dayoji's brother, Karshanji, who was following. Prabhupada knows that it's a sensitive issue. The impetus for the establishment of ISKCON Fiji arose originally from Dayoji's and his brother's enthusiasm to invite Prabhupada there. Prabhupada doesn't want to act in such a way that might strike people as arbitrary. Thus, he advised Madhadvisa to arrange everything locally with a consensus of agreement. He said, if any of the trustees are to be dropped, this is to be discussed between the trustees themselves. These are all important men, and we should be careful lest they become offended. If I say something, it will not look well. If some of the trustees are not abiding by the principles or not chanting 16 rounds, then they should be induced by the other trustees who are following to step down. I think you can follow what I mean. So that was arranged. They were able to do that, but that was the principle. You couldn't be, you know, legally, or you couldn't be in any kind of managerial position unless you were up to this standard of four regulative principles and chanting 16 rounds, Prabhupada insisted, even if you weren't initiated. Sometimes in circumstances like that in Fiji where, you know, we were setting up the society, these men were well-wishers, but they weren't practicing. They were giving a lot of money to build the temple in their enthusiasm. And because of, you know, their donations, etc., then they were made trustees. But that was, Prabhupada understood that's going to be a problem later on. So he had them changed. So anyway, not long after that, then Madhavisa came to India. And he arrived just when we were leaving for Mayapur. So on January the 18th, we were having a little get-together in Prabhupada's room. And Madhavisa was asking a few managerial questions regarding ISKCON Fiji. Dayalji Punja, who was instrumental in establishing ISKCON there, is chanting the Maha Mantra and following the regulative principles. He is channeling money from his supermarket and other shops into building the temple. But meanwhile, he is still selling meat and liquor in the stores. So they had the biggest supermarket on the island. And of course, you know, they had to sell everything that people want. So there was a big meat section and a liquor section and everything like this. So Madhavisa expressed uncertainty about whether to tell him to cease such activities or not, because it was his business. And he had that before he met the devotees. So Prabhupada said that he should be allowed to continue and not be forced to give it up. He quoted the Bhagavad Gita, 18:48. Every endeavor is covered by some sort of fault, just as fire is covered by smoke. Therefore, one should not give up the work which is born of his nature, O son of Kunti, even if such work is full of fault. And Prabhupada expressed confidence that if he is chanting Hare Krishna, then these things will soon be properly adjusted. So nothing was said, and within 2 months, Dayalji actually broke the business up, because it was a family business, so he had brothers. And generally, you know, you get these family businesses in India, they're very tight. You know, even if one of the brothers does something wrong, they don't get rid of them. They keep them in the business. But it became so intolerable for Dayalji, because he was chanting to sell meat and liquor, that he just couldn't do it anymore. And so he voluntarily broke the business up, gave it to his brothers. He took his share, and then he started some prasadam restaurants and some ice cream parlors. And in that way, then he continued on. So Prabhupada said, no, don't say anything. If he's chanting, it will happen. And it did. So again, there was another example where Prabhupada stressed this principle of chanting 16 rounds as the main criteria for management. Yasamadi Nandana Prabhu from Gujarat, he had invited Prabhupada to come to Ahmedabad on the last week of December in 1975. We'd done a series of pandals at a small town called Sanand. It's about 20,000 population. And then when we finished that program, it was a 5-day program, Prabhupada went back to Ahmedabad and Yaso took him around to see some buildings that he was considering renting so that he could start a ISKCON temple there. So now on January the 10th, about 10 days later, Yaso sent an update on his attempts to secure a suitable center in Ahmedabad. The building that he had taken Prabhupada to see had several defects, and since then he had located a better place in the city center, but he said it was only available initially for a 3-month period. The owners are thinking of using it for some charitable cause, and so Prabhupada encouraged him to accept it despite the time limit. He said, even if you can stay only for 3 months, what is the loss? You can always look for another place. Now people are seeing how genuine our movement is, and they are coming forward to offer us so many places. We simply have to maintain our strict principles, keeping ourselves pure. Otherwise, there are so many bogus institutions doing business in the name of God and simply cheating people. We have to be careful not to degenerate like these others. Our strength depends upon regular chanting the required number of 16 rounds and rigidly adhering to the regulative principles. So that, Prabhupada said, don't worry about it. You know, there'll be lots of offers. If you have the proper standard, people will recognize that. But if it just becomes a business, you know, a transaction, ordinary transaction, everything will be useless. Yes, Dravida Prabhu. I have a very big section about Kirtan and Harinam. Yeah. Well, this is a long, this module on chanting, it takes me about 7 hours to get through it all. And we've only had a couple of sessions, so we've only done a couple of hours so far. And there is a very long section on Kirtan, different aspects of that. Shri Gonitai Ki Jai, Shri Rukmini Dwakadish Ki Jai, Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Devi Ki Jai. If you want to jump ahead, we can do that. let me see, I don't think there's much left on this, but... there's not much left on the japa. We could... If you want, does everybody want to skip ahead now? We've done enough on japa. We can do a bit on kirtan. Everybody who wants to skip ahead, put your hands up. Everybody who wants to continue, put your hands up. All right, we continue. We've got another, about half an hour, yeah? Before the temple closes. Oh, I think they close the temple at 8:30, don't they? Yeah, they kick us out, so... We got half an hour. Alright, so we'll go on with the kirtan. So, maintaining spiritual strength with 16 rounds. That was very important. And what happens when you don't chant your 16 rounds? So, as I mentioned, there was this one secretary that was with Prabhupada when I was on the party. And he stopped chanting his rounds. And consequently had a lot of problems. So that was Pushta Krishna Swami. He had come on in early March, and he had been made Prabhupada's permanent secretary for the year, at least for that year. And he was on the party for about 4 months. So not long after he'd been on the party, it only took a couple of weeks, it started becoming evident that he was having problems, you know, chanting his rounds. And on April the 23rd, we'd been in Melbourne. We had just started the last world tour. We'd flown from Bombay, arrived in Melbourne on the 19th of April. And then on the 23rd, the temple president there, Balaram Prabhu, he passed on some rather disturbing information to me in the afternoon. He said that Pushta Krishna Swami had admitted that he was only presently chanting 2 rounds of japa instead of the prescribed 16. The reason he gave was that he was overloaded with work because he has to transcribe Srila Prabhupada's nightly dictations from the Srimad Bhagavatam, as well as do all the other services of the secretary. Now, this is a problem that I'm not sure how to deal with. I don't want to disturb Prabhupada with it. He's got enough to contend with without having to worry about his own party. At the same time, I'm reluctant to approach Pushta Krishna about it. He might not take it well. He's an intelligent man, but he doesn't like to hear criticism of himself or any suggestion that he might not be doing things correctly. It was a little difficult. The other day I was telling Balaram about the car crash that we had when we left Vrindavan 2 weeks ago and the damage to Prabhupada's new Mercedes. That was a whole episode in itself. We were driving along back to Delhi. Pushta was driving. He had actually bought that Mercedes in Germany and driven it overland with, I think, Ritter. And they brought it to the Mayapur Festival. It was for Prabhupada's use in India. Then they drove it over from Mayapur to Vrindavan. Now Prabhupada was setting off to Bombay. And then from Bombay we were going out for 4 months on this world tour. So the car had to be left in Delhi. And it was going to be turned over to Chaita Guru Das, one of the Indian brahmacharis, to look after. So we had left Vrindavan early in the morning, and Pushta was driving, and Chaita Guru was in the front passenger seat. Prabhupada was behind him, and I was behind Pushta Krishna in the back. So we got to, there's a place called Paliwal, which is about an hour outside of Delhi. And there's a divided, in those days, that was the only stretch of road that was divided. Now the entire highway from Delhi to Vrindavan, or Agra, is a divided highway. But in those days, it was used to be a single track. And then there was this divided highway just in Paliwal. So when we came into Paliwal, he was doing about 70 miles an hour, which is pretty fast in India, you know, because you never know what's going to jump out in front of you. You know, a camel or a pig or a donkey or a cow or whatever. So he's doing about 70 miles an hour and he starts telling Chaitaguru, you know, about looking after the car, and he's pointing out all the dials, what this does and what that does and like this, and he's not looking in front. And I was looking through the back window, and so was Srila Prabhupada, I mean through the front window from the back, and so was Srila Prabhupada. And up ahead, we saw there was a camel cart. And then behind that, there was a horse and cart with heaps of straw on it. In India, they have these little, skinny little horses. And then they have a little, you know, cart at the back, two-wheel, wooden wheels. And they stack them up, way up, you know, with whatever they're carrying. So they had this straw on, and there were a couple of guys sitting up on the straw there. And this horse and cart was gradually pulling out into the middle of the road to overtake the camel cart. And in the middle of the road, there was a divider with a very high curb. So I'm looking and I'm thinking, geez, we're getting pretty close. And I was thinking, no, maybe I should say something. And then I was thinking, no, Pustar will get angry if I say anything. And then after a couple of more seconds, I realized he'd better look up right now, because if he doesn't, we're finished. And I was just going to say something, and he looked up. And he saw this, you know, horse and cart had come way over, and it actually, there wasn't enough room to get past. And we were going so fast, he couldn't, you know, he couldn't stop. And he just went, oh, Krishna. He slams on the brakes, the wheels lock, right, and we start to skid. So he had to let go of the brakes. So he tried to squeeze between this horse and cart and the curb. And what happened was we got about 3/4 of the way past and hit it. So the wooden axle smashed into Prabhupada's door. And, I mean, it was a miracle that nothing, you know, came through. The window, you know, all glories to Mercedes-Benz, the window stayed intact. But the door actually popped. And there was, you could see, you know, daylight through the top seal there. And we kind of jutted through. And because the car was big and heavy and it was going so fast, we just kept on going. And typically, there was an ambassador that had seen us going through. So they tucked in behind us. You know, they always do this. Any little space in India, if it's free, you know, somebody gets in there. So he was trying to follow through. But because the horse and cart came smashing down, the wheel was ripped off. And I looked out the back, this big heap of straw, and these men fell down in the straw, and then this ambassador ran right into the whole thing. So we just kept on going, because if you stop an accident in India, you're dead. There's no question. There'll be a riot. They'll set fire to the car, and they'll kill you. So we had to keep on going. And Prabhupada was in the back, and he was so angry. I've never seen anything like it. There were different kind of stages of anger. You know, Prabhupada would use like sarcasm sometimes. If you were doing something mildly wrong, he would chastise you. He'd sometimes use sarcasm. But if it was, you know, something really silly, then he might get really, you know, annoyed with you and shout at you. And Prabhupada shouted at you. I mean, it was a really, it was a heart-rending, you know, experience. When Prabhupada shouted, he really shouted. But it was, you know, he always felt relief afterwards because it was corrective. But there was another stage when if he got really super angry as he did in this, he wouldn't say anything at all. And that was the worst. If you got shouted at least it was being dealt with. But if Prabhupada was so angry that he didn't even say anything, then you knew you'd committed a really serious offense. And, you know, we were sitting in the back. We smashed through this thing. And then Prabhupada started to say something. He said, "You are going so fast." And then he just bit his lip and he kept quiet. And he sat there in stony silence, you know, for the rest of the drive into Delhi. Pushed us sitting there. He couldn't do anything. Anyway, so we got to Melbourne a couple of weeks later. Well, actually, when we got out in Delhi, we couldn't open the door, so Prabhupada had to get out the other side. Then when we walked round, there was a huge hole in the door of this brand new Mercedes. So anyway, Pushta Krishna got down and offered his obeisances, but at the time I actually felt like he didn't really, you know, clear the offense. It just somehow or another struck me that he didn't really, you know, wholeheartedly, you know, clear that offense. So later on when we were in Melbourne, I'd been telling Balaram about the car crash, and Pushta Krishna overheard us, and he came up and he said, "That's not what happened," like that, and he got into me about it. He wouldn't admit that it was his fault. So then I understood he's still got this offense. Anyway, so this was his situation. He was only chanting two rounds a day. And I didn't know what to do about it. So for the time being, I thought I'll just sit on it and see how things go. So later on, we were in New Brindavan. This was like at the end of June. So April, May, about 2 months later. So Pushta Krishna Swami appears to be having some personal problems. He half jokes about being in Maya, and he makes oblique remarks about how difficult it is to control the senses and the mind. His sadhana is very irregular, and he's oversleeping, and he's still not chanting all his rounds. He had excused himself to Balaram in Melbourne that he was overworked, but now it appears that there is more to it. He's approached Prajumna for advice, and today Prajumna discussed his situation with me. We both agreed something practical must be done, and so we decided that the best thing, rather than disturb Srila Prabhupada, was to get Tamal Krishna Goswami to talk to him when we arrive in New York in 2 weeks' time. So about a week later, we were in Washington on the 7th of July. Pushta Krishna Maharaj spoke with me today about his service, and he asked me if I thought that he should change his engagement. So he'd been brought on, you know, as Prabhupada's permanent secretary, but now he was talking about leaving the party. So he has already talked with Tamal Krishna Maharaj and admitted experiencing trouble in chanting his rounds and keeping regulated. He told me that he's finding it increasingly difficult to travel with Srila Prabhupada because he feels that he needs to speak the philosophy himself in order to keep enlivened. It's a fact that being with his divine grace means hearing rather than speaking most of the time. And Pushta feels that by keeping himself in the background, his consciousness is becoming stagnant. I said that I thought it would be good for him to preach. So that was the point that he was getting to. I personally used to enjoy, you know, hearing Prabhupada, as anybody would, hearing Prabhupada talk. And when you were with Srila Prabhupada, probably you'd spend about 4 to 5 hours every day just hearing Prabhupada preaching. On the morning walk, then in the class, in darshans, dealing with his managers, doing the mail. It's all preaching. And, you know, you just sit there and have this wonderful opportunity to just, you know, drink in all this nectar every single day. But Pushta Krishna was just, you know, he got to this point, his mind was becoming disturbed because he wasn't chanting. And so he wanted to leave the party. So July the 13th, then we were in New York, when Pushta Krishna Swami talked directly to Srila Prabhupada on July 10th about his desire to leave his present service, his divine grace was not at all pleased. Pushta's rationale was that he needed a situation where he could preach more often. He explained that his mind was unsteady and his spiritual life so unregulated that he was unable to chant even his 16 rounds properly. Prabhupada countered him that he could not possibly have a better situation than traveling with his spiritual master. Prabhupada asked me today during massage what I thought. When I said that he complains about being unable to control his mind, Prabhupada made a sour face and he shook his head disapprovingly. He said it was due to insincerity. So he had discussions, he talked with Srila Prabhupada about it, and still he couldn't rectify it. It was a very unfortunate situation. So then finally on July 20th, it was decided during that last week in New York that he would leave the party and then he would go to the West Coast. So he came here as the new GBC. So he had given me a letter to read to Srila Prabhupada after we left New York. He said, don't give it to him before, give it to him once you leave New York and you're on the aeroplane. So as soon as we settled in on the flight on July 20th in the evening, we were flying to London, then I pulled out this letter and I told Srila Prabhupada, you know, Pushtakrishna's given this letter. So Prabhupada said, open it and read it. So he had me read it there on the aeroplane. So Prabhupada listened carefully as Pushta described how he found himself now struggling to maintain his spiritual consciousness. As of late, I've been battling with the material energy, and I fear my consciousness has been dangerously polluted in this struggle. My memory of substantive reality has given way to hopelessness and fatigue under the heavy pressure of the whirlwind modes of material nature. I feel as though I've slipped from the safety of the transcendental boat, and I'm being swallowed up by the waves of futility and despair. Desires have entered my mind from all directions, and it has been a weary struggle against fate. So that was how he was seeing it, that he was fated to fall down, basically. So Prabhupada heard that. He said that he realized he must have brought this upon himself, but he declared, I don't have the strength to wage the war any longer. But somehow or another, by a shred of your loving mercy, I'm hanging on to your lotus feet and praying for this terrible phenomenon to pass. He finished by making a plea for Prabhupada's blessings to carry on and to give him the strength to endure this brutal onslaught. It was yet another headache, yet another senior sannyasi disciple experiencing spiritual difficulty. Prabhupada simply shook his head and murmured, he is not sincere. And then he turned away, chanting softly on his beads. So and then within a couple of months, actually, then Pushta did give up his service. And then he left. Of course, then later on, he wrote to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada encouraged him. He told him to get married and then take up, you know, full-time service. He said, it doesn't matter if you have to get married, but keep on with your service. So Prabhupada kept on encouraging him. But the point was there that he wasn't chanting his 16 rounds. And because he wasn't chanting his rounds, therefore he was always on the mental platform. And he was a very intelligent man, Pushtakrishna. I mean, not a lot of devotees know him. He's a very smart guy. But being intelligent is not enough. You actually have to have the purifying effects of the holy names. Otherwise, you can't maintain your service, even if you're with Srila Prabhupada. And, of course, Prabhupada, you know, he has said in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he says there that the personal servants of the deity and the spiritual master have to be very careful. Because, you know, a fire can burn or it can warm you up, depending on how you handle it. So when you're coming in very close contact with the spiritual master or with the deities, then you have to be up to a very strict standard. Otherwise, you make offenses and then you get more reactions than you would do if you didn't do that service at all. So that was one example. There were other examples also of devotees having problems because of not chanting the 16 rounds. So a couple of other little japa pastimes before we may have enough time to get onto some kirtan. Prabhupada, as I mentioned the other night, any spare time that he had, he would be chanting japa. So sometimes he would slip out and sit by himself and just chant when he had a free moment. Or on the aeroplanes, he was always chanting. One time when we had gone to Detroit, we were just settling in because we'd just got that big mansion. And it was Prabhupada's first evening there. So they'd given him a nice big room, very opulent place. And there was a thick carpet on the floor, but the devotees decided that they'd try to make it like, you know, in India. In India, we always had these thin cotton mattresses, and then you would cover them with white sheets. Then when they get dirty, you just remove the sheets, wash them, and, you know, put more on. It's very practical. So the devotees decided to put white sheets over this carpet in Prabhupada's room. So they didn't have, I guess they didn't have time to stitch them together or something, but there were strips. And so Prabhupada was walking up and down as I was unpacking. He was chanting japa. So as he's walking up and down, he stopped all of a sudden. He bent down and he pulled a pin out of the sheeting, because you know, instead of stitching them, they'd pinned the sheets together and the pins were sticking up. Prabhupada was walking up and down and trod on one of them. It didn't pierce his foot, but he just, he said, they have no common sense. So I had to go through and pull out all the pins. So that was another little japa pastime. Then there was another one that wasn't, it wasn't Prabhupada chanting, but some of the devotees. Krita, were you in Bhubaneswar in 77 when we had the foundation stone ceremony? You missed that. All right. Anyway, so Guru Kripa and his party, they had come to India in 77 to have a little time with Srila Prabhupada. They'd been collecting in Japan. And then Prabhupada was going to Bhubaneswar to do the foundation stone ceremony for the temple there on Lord Nityananda's appearance day. So we were there about 10 days in Bhubaneswar. And about halfway through the visit, Prabhupada went to Jagannath Puri. That was on the 25th and 26th of January. Now, previously, Prabhupada said that he would not go to Jagannath Puri unless they allowed his disciples into the temple there. And the last time he'd been there was 1958. So, when we got to Bhubaneswar, then Gagamuni was telling Prabhupada that he'd found, you know, various plots of land that were for sale in Jagannath Puri, and we could build a big temple there. Because we were there to, you know, establish this temple in Bhubaneswar. But when we got there, the place was like a desert. It's just this vacant, you know, block of land that Gogovinda Maharaj had gotten. He had one little brick building with a thatched roof on it. And he'd only just got the electricity on because Prabhupada told him he wouldn't go there unless he had electricity. Because he couldn't do his Bhagavatam work. And you know, there was nothing for miles. It was just vacant land, brown, dry, like a desert. So we were all thinking, you know, why are we building something here? We're only an hour from Jagannath Puri. So there was a kind of a bit of a clamor there from, you know, some of the senior men, Bhavananda and Guru Kripa and Gagamuni, that we should try to get something in Puri. Because Prabhupada wasn't in agreement that, you know, it was useless building in Bhubaneswar. He said, actually, in the future, this will be very important. And it's actually become a fact. But anyway, so Gagamuni persuaded Prabhupada that we could go to Jagannath Puri and see these plots of land that were for sale. So we went there on the 25th morning, and we intended to stay just the day and then come back. But whilst we were there, the word went out, and this man called Sadashiva Rutt, he was a pujari in the main temple. He came in the afternoon. We were staying in this tourist bungalow number one in one of the rooms upstairs. And he came to see Prabhupada and asked Prabhupada if he would inaugurate a new book that had just been printed. And he was having a pandal the next day on the 26th to inaugurate this book. So would Prabhupada, you know, consent to come to his pandal? So Prabhupada said, all right. So then we stayed overnight. And the next day we went to this man's pandal. That was also a nice incident, because it was a very small thing. He had like a raised stage about 3 feet off the ground. There was a number of pujaris and pandas from the temple in the on the back of the stage. Then when we came, there was about maybe 20 of our devotees. And Prabhupada got up on the stage and we all sat down on, it was like a sandy area. And he was given this book, so Prabhupada put it down, and then he gave his speech. So in the speech, he spent half an hour getting on their cases about why they're not allowing the foreign devotees into the Jagannath temple. And he was telling them, he said, his name is Jagannath. He said, don't make him Ariyanath or Purinath. He said, if the people of the Jagat want to come and see the Lord, then they should be allowed in. So he went on and on like this. I saw one or two of the pujaris at the back. They got up and walked off, actually. They didn't like it. But Prabhupada didn't care. So then at the end, he stopped. And then I was sitting in front, and Prabhupada looked down at me, and he kind of tipped his head. So, shall we go? So I shrugged. I said, okay. And Prabhupada started to get up. And then Sadashiva Rat was there and he said, the book, you had to inaugurate the book. And then Prabhupada said, oh, so they gave him the book and Prabhupada held it up. He said, this is the Bhagwat of, you know, they say it's the Bhagwat of such and such a person. So today it is inaugurated. And that was it. He put it down and off we went. So anyway, in reciprocation, Prabhupada had invited Sadashiva Rat to come to the foundation stone ceremony for our Bhubaneswar temple on Lord Nityananda's appearance day. So that was on February the 2nd. So we had a stage there. And then in the evening, Prabhupada came out onto the pandal. This was at the back of our land. And this time, instead of him speaking himself, he had spoken in the morning, he allowed Sadashiva Rat to deliver the lecture. So he went on and on and on for about 3/4 of an hour. And then finally he finished, we had a kirtan. So towards the end of his lecture, which was all in Aryan, Guru Kripa Swami and his men, who were all sitting on the stage behind him, were becoming quite agitated that he was going on and on and on. So they took out their japa beads and they began to chant quite loudly as a hint to the men that he should be stopped. He should stop because we were all becoming bored. Prabhupada was sitting on the stage and surprised, I saw Guru Kripa, he said, Hare Krishna, 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 like this. And all the other Namhata boys did the same thing. Sadashiva's giving his lecture. Prabhupada's sitting there and I saw Guru Kripa look over to Prabhupada a couple of times to see how Prabhupada would react. And Prabhupada didn't say anything. He just sat there. So eventually then the man took the hint and he stopped. So then we all went off the stage and we went back to Prabhupada's rooms. So in the room afterwards, Guru Kripa asked Srila Prabhupada if this was the etiquette. Prabhupada said, well, it's better to let them speak. He said, after all, he is a learned scholar. He spoke many things, but there was no conclusion. He's a householder after all. So Prabhupada, by this, indicated that these men are professional speakers and they use their learning to speak at various meetings to earn a living to support their families, but they have no real idea what is the actual conclusion of the Shastra. So anyway, that was a kind of a funny japa pastime there. And a couple of last things, of course you can ask, we've stressed about always chanting japa. Is there a time when it's okay not to chant japa? And of course there are sometimes when it's not possible. And the most obvious example is that of Haridas Thakur. He was, when he got very, very old, he was unable to complete his rounds. And we saw also similarly with Srila Prabhupada, that in the last few months, he was so incapacitated, of course, that he was unable to even roll over in the bed by himself. He had to be moved, you know, just to change positions or to sit up. His whole body was so depleted that he couldn't even move anymore. And so chanting japa was not really an option. So Prabhupada had us do 24-hour kirtan in the room with him, but he wasn't chanting japa. So there may be a time when we get to that point where physically it becomes impossible to chant japa anymore. So at that point we have to train so that, you know, our consciousness is such that we're fixed on chanting even if we're not, you know, physically handling the beads. But there were a couple of other times also that I heard about, I didn't experience, but Hansaduta, when he was Prabhupada's secretary, he told me that when they had first come to India, the first batch of devotees, then, you know, they were so busy, they were getting invitations to go to different pandals and whole programs, 3, 4, and sometimes 5 programs in a day. And Jai Shri Shri Gonitai, Shri Shri Rukmini Dwarkadish, Jagannath, Baladev, Subhadra Devi, Ki Jai. So after a couple of months, he went to Srila Prabhupada and he told Prabhupada, he said, we're just so busy, I can't get my rounds done. I haven't chanted 16 rounds for weeks and weeks. So Prabhupada's response was, he said, it doesn't matter. He said, this is an emergency. So he just let him continue like that because he was working very hard. And then also similarly, Shyamasundar Prabhu, when they had gone to London and they were setting up to open up the Buddy Place Temple, the first temple in London. So he was the temple president. He was kind of like the GBC. And he was also the main construction man. So he was designing and building the altars. So some of the devotees, after a while, they went to Srila Prabhupada. And they said, Prabhupada, Shyama Sunda's not chanting his rounds. So Prabhupada said, that's all right. He said, Arjuna wasn't chanting rounds either. He was fighting a war. So he excused him. But of course, we shouldn't take those examples as, you know, a precedent that, oh, now we don't need to chant our rounds. We can just work very hard, because you may end up like Prabhupada's secretary and end up leaving. So you have to be careful always to chant. And there was one other personality that Prabhupada actually put in a position. He increased his position, even though he knew that he wasn't chanting. And this was in March 1976. The GBC had been having their meetings, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj had been voted in as the new GBC chairman. And then Prabhupada called in Tamal Krishna Maharaj into his room on March the 8th, and he told him that Madhadvisa Swami should be made the GBC vice chairman for the year, and that Gagamuni Swami should be given GBC responsibility. Tamal Krishna Maharaj replied that the GBC had already considered Gagamuni, but they decided not to appoint him because he does not regularly chant his rounds. Some of Gagamuni's men have left him, complaining that his devotional standard is not strict. Prabhupada said that despite this, he should become a GBC member, the reason being that Gagamuni has creative energy that should be used constructively. Otherwise, he said, he may become frustrated and misapply it. So Prabhupada knew his men. And he knew Gagamuni was, you know, he was a sharp guy. He always had good ideas. He was very energetic. But he was a very troublesome character to deal with. And Prabhupada felt, now if I don't, you know, keep him occupied and make him the GBC, that will give him lots to do. It's like the genie in the bottle. Then if you let him loose, then he may cause all kinds of havoc. So better to keep him, you know, where he can see what he's doing and keep him busy. There's one other example, actually, I just remembered. And that was when we went to Detroit. So one devotee had just been made the new temple president there, Madhavananda Prabhu. And the old temple president was Govardhan. He had been there for quite a few years, done a lot of service, but he was not chanting his rounds. And so he had been removed by the GBC, and another temple president had been put in his place. So Prabhupada didn't say anything the week that we were in Detroit. He was dealing with Madhavananda. He'd asked about Govardhan. And that was it. He just let it pass. But then when we left Detroit and went to Toronto, then the next day, Prabhupada brought this up in a conversation with Jagadish. He was the GBC at that time. Why Govardhan is not the temple president there anymore? So Jagadish said, well, you know, he's a very nice devotee. He's a gentle soul. Everybody likes him, but he's weak. He's not chanting his rounds. So then Prabhupada said, no. He said, now Madhavananda's there. He said, I received some complaints whilst I was there about him. And he said, anyway, he said, Govardhan was doing a good job. And he said, he is friends with Ambarish. So on account of him, Ambarish, you know, has given the money for this temple. So he said, that service must be recognized. So he said, you know, my feeling is that he should be made the temple president again. Well, then Jagadish responded, well, then should we make him the president again? And Prabhupada said, no, he said, that is your decision. He said, I'm not going to interfere like that. But he dropped, you know, a strong hint. So then Jagadish said, well, we can make him the temple president. And Prabhupada said, yes, but he must chant his 16 rounds. You have to speak to him and he has to chant. So he wanted him back in, but he said he has to chant. So there's a few practical examples. How long can we go for here? 9 o'clock? Are we sure? Who's in charge here? All right, we'll just keep speaking until we get kicked out. Yeah.
Thank you.
I never heard this before. Okay. Yeah, he wouldn't have been so passionate if he'd have been chanting his rams. All right, good story. Okay, so we'll talk a little bit about kirtan as much as we can. That's the other aspect. We've done japa. Prabhupada talked many times, of course, about chanting in the holy dharm. I was fortunate enough to spend 4 months in Vrindavan and 4 months in Mayapur with Srila Prabhupada. And especially in Mayapur, it was very nice because we had this 24-hour kirtan going on. And there was one family, they'd come from Bangladesh. Interesting story, actually, because there was this family, this man came, he had 4 or 5 sons. And they had escaped from Bangladesh during the war in 1971. And they'd come over the border, and they arrived in Nabadweep, literally penniless. They had nothing. They had no possessions, they had no money, they had no food, nothing. So they couldn't find anywhere in Nabadweep to stay. And people there told them, why don't you go over the river to the ISKCON center? Maybe this was 72. So they turned up at the gate there and just begged to be allowed to come and stay with us. So they were all brought in. And, you know, all the young boys there, they were all the first Gurukul kids in Mayapur. One of them, his name's Baninath, he just died in Mayapur about a month ago. He had severe diabetes and he got some complication. But his father, anyway, his main service was to sit in the temple and chant. So there were a couple of Bengali devotees, that was their whole service. They would just chant 8 hours a day. Beautiful kirtan. And when Prabhupada came in 76, he would sit in his room and I could see he was just listening to this kirtan coming out from below. And I went in one morning and Prabhupada said, this kirtan should never stop. It must go on 24 hours. This is the beauty of this movement. This is the life of this movement. So I really liked it. And again, later on, after Gopurnima, on March the 19th, Mayapur is again peaceful. Most of the pilgrims have returned home. Many of our devotees have left, and work is recommencing on the new building. Prabhupada was sitting quietly in his room, relishing the blissful atmosphere created by the melodic Bengali kirtan floating out from the temple room below. He told us that chanting is the only solace. It is nothing material. He even suggested that 500 men at a time could come here to Mayapur simply to chant. So... And there was one other time when I was massaging Prabhupada, that evening massage. It was very quiet. It was probably about 11:30 at night. And then we could hear this kirtan coming over the river from Nabadweep side. And it was Hare Krishna kirtan. So Prabhupada was listening to that. Then he smiled and he told me, he said, before we came, he said, you would never hear this. He said, they never chanted Hare Krishna, but he said, now that we're here, now they're all doing it. So people kind of, you know, the local mats, they clicked on that actually chanting Hare Krishna, that brings you a lot of success. So they were emulating Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada was very happy that they were doing that. So, of course, Prabhupada often said that people in India are natural devotees. You know, they just naturally chant Hare Krishna. You don't really have to say much to them. They'll automatically take it up. And my first experience of that was when Prabhupada went to Sanand in Gujarat. That was the last week of December. We flew there on December 25th. And we had a 5-day pandal. So when we arrived in Sanand, then we were met in this reception area, open field it was, by the king of Sanand. So it sounds very grand, but King of Sanand means, you know, a village of 20,000 people. He was an old man, about 70 years old. He was just the very epitome of, you know, the Indian Maharajas. Big belly, big turban, big beard, like this. Nice man. And he used to invite sadhus to come to his town and, you know, give some pandals and things. So he received Srila Prabhupada, and then this horse and carriage drew up, a big silver carriage, fancy. And then the Maharaj got up on one side and Prabhupada got up on the other side. And then I was standing behind Srila Prabhupada on the carriage holding an umbrella. And then we went off on an hour-long parade through the streets of Sanand. So it was wonderful. All along the route, excited people clamored to get a glimpse of Srila Prabhupada and his foreign disciples. A large crowd preceded us, with several hundred ladies following behind. As the procession wound its way through the town, the ladies spontaneously burst into chanting, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, without any prompting from our devotees. We only had about four or five of us. Hayagriva was there, Yaso was there with his wife, and then, you know, there was Prabhupada and his party, a Hazardu to myself and Hari Kesh. So they were all off up the front. Hari Kesh was taking photographs. I was on the carriage. So nobody was behind, but all these ladies, there's like a few hundred of them, they just spontaneously burst out chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. Prabhupada was smiling when he heard it. It was really nice. So it was, although I've read that in Srila Prabhupada's books, that village people in India are naturally inclined to be devotees, to actually see it practically manifested was a very moving experience. The reception was spontaneous and genuinely heartwarming. There's a piety in India, especially in the villages, that simply doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. So it was very nice to see that chanting. Now, an example of the potency of chanting, that came in a letter later on. Hari Kesh was on the party when I joined. He was Prabhupada's cook and he was transcribing his tapes. Then he got very sick. And when we got to Mayapur in 76, he was getting sicker and sicker every day. And, you know, it came to a point where he realized he was going to have to go back to the West if he wanted to recover his health. And he had also kind of pressured Srila Prabhupada a bit that he wanted to take sannyas. And I remember one evening, he spent about an hour with Srila Prabhupada trying to convince him that he should be given sannyas. And Prabhupada kept saying no. You know, he kept refuting all his arguments. So then he came out. And then the next morning at about 4 o'clock in the morning, Prabhupada rang the bell. I ran in and he said, go and get me Tamal Krishna. Because he had just arrived as the secretary for that month. So Tamal came in. And then Prabhupada said, so I'm going to give sannyas to Hari Kesh. He just spent an hour the evening before telling him no. And then he thought about it in the nighttime and then he changed his mind. So he was given sannyas. And it was decided he was going to come to America. And he would join one of the Radha Damodar traveling Sankirtan buses. And then Prabhupada said, let him see how he goes for a year. And if he's doing all right, then you can give him charge of one of the buses. So off he flew. And he was coming via London. So he arrived in London. And then there was this devotee, German devotee, Alanath. And he had just received an invitation to go to a yoga school in Hungary. So these people apparently had come out from Hungary. They were in Sweden and they met our devotees on the street. And they got very excited that his, you know, some yogis from India. And they were doing yoga. So they invited our devotees, if you ever come to Hungary, we want you to come and do a program. So Alanath was just about to go. And Hari Kesh arrived in London. So he said, why don't you come with me? So instead of going on to America, he immediately flew off to Hungary. And that was the beginning of his Eastern European preaching. Anyway, so we didn't hear much about that, except that we heard that he hadn't arrived in America, because naturally from Hungary, you know, there wasn't much communication in those days because it was communist. So then on March the 7th, about a month after he'd taken sannyas, a letter came today from Hari Kesh Swami. It was a long, detailed and ecstatic report of his recent and unexpected preaching trip to Hungary. He explained that when passing through London, he had met Alanath Das, I was just preparing to go to Hungary in response to this invitation from a yoga school, and he had invited Harikesh, and he gladly accepted. So taking books, pamphlets, posters, and instruments, the two of them met with great success. Although they were highly restricted in what they could say, the Hungarians' reception to Kirtan and Prasadam was extraordinary. I simply engaged them in Kirtan, Harikesh wrote, and made them all kinds of nice prasadam, which they went wild over. The Hungarians like to eat a lot, and they are so poor, and they don't have much selection of foods, and they never had anything so nice. Milk and grains and milk products are very cheap, and this is the basis of our prasadam. So I made very much, and very opulently, halava and puris, and a drink made from whey, and sometimes simply wonderfuls, and they loved it. They couldn't believe how anything could taste so good. So from the point of view of prasadam, they became completely convinced. And what to speak of kirtan? After a short while, they learned to chant the mantra and play kartals, and we started having kirtans, which seemed to me to be as good as any kirtan in any temple in the movement. They chanted and danced like real madmen, and they would go on as long as I could. Every night we had very raging hour-long kirtans, where at the end everybody collapsed on the floor in ecstasy. And then we gave them prasadam while I chanted bhajans, which they fell over themselves to record. It even occurred in public that although I always tried to cover up the philosophy out of fear of being stopped and thrown out of the country, these people became so enlightened due to the ecstatic kirtan that they actually forced me to speak about Krishna, even though they didn't have any idea what was the force behind the chanting. I started speaking out about the soul very reluctantly, and I was refusing to do it. But all of a sudden, out of my control, a Sanskrit verse, Nityam Shasvatoyam Purana, etc., came out of my mouth, and they all jumped on me as if half crazed, demanding to know what was that. And I had to surrender and pray to Krishna for protection, and I started to explain everything to them. The translator became so excited that her face lighted up like a Christmas tree, and she became so excited that she could no longer speak properly. It seems that this is what they've been waiting for, because their lives are so very empty. But they were all afraid for us at the end, because what I had said was very revolutionary. So despite the restrictions for speaking, Daily Karoli, the yoga instructor who had organized the programs, will organize outdoor kirtans and wants the devotees to return as soon as possible. Included in his letter were photos of men and women dancing with upraised arms and japa beads around their necks. There is such a demand that he hopes to return frequently and visit Bulgaria, Romania, and East Germany in the summer. He asked if he should make a recording of the chanting, because he predicted, along with prasadam, it would sweep the country. Harikesh described his experience as the most wonderful of my whole life. He also asked if he should continue on to join the Radha Damodar Party in America or remain to preach in Europe. Prabhupada was delighted with his report. He told me, "This is needed to travel and preach and make new devotees." So after so many months of getting trained by Prabhupada how to defeat Marxist philosophy, it seems that Krishna has now given Harikesh the opportunity to use it. And that was, you know, another feature of that. Harikesh ending up in Eastern Europe. When I joined the party, Harikesh was lamenting because, you know, I was made the full-time servant, and then, you know, it meant he was giving up some of his service, and he was kind of lamenting and a bit of anxiety that maybe, you know, there wouldn't be enough for him to do and he would have to leave the party. So that was at the end of November in 75. But what Prabhupada did was he started to engage Harikesh in writing, and particularly, he wanted him to write essays defeating, you know, the communist philosophy. And of course, at that time, nothing was going on in the communist countries. And there was no indication at all that Prabhupada actually wanted Harikesh to go there. But he just had him, you know, come in every day, and on the morning walks, they would debate, you know, all the principles of scientific materialism, which was the basis of the communist state philosophy. And it even got to the point when we were in Sanand, Harry Kesh had gotten a small book explaining the essence of, you know, Lenin's philosophy, Marxism, etc. And he'd gone through that book. Then he came up on the roof when Prabhupada was having his massage. And then they discussed, you know, all these different points. So Prabhupada kind of gave him all this training. He told him, you know, to write articles against defeating communism, etc. But then when he left the party, he was going to America, you know, to join the Radha Damodar party. And then all of a sudden he got diverted into Eastern Europe. And that's where he ended up for many years. He was preaching there. So, you know, it just seemed like Krishna and Prabhupada had arranged that, you know, that he got this training and then he got the right place to go and use it. So Prabhupada replied, encouraging him to take the newly found opportunity to preach to the communists. He approved his plans for mass kirtan and prasadam distribution, but he advised him to preach very tactfully in such places. He said that printing our books can wait. First, let their hearts be cleansed by chanting Hare Krishna and taking Krishna prasadam. To take birth in such a place is due to an impious past, so it is not easy for them to immediately accept our philosophy. He ended by advising him to work with Kirtiraj Prabhu to introduce the Sankirtan movement to Eastern Europe. So that, because Kirtiraj was doing some preaching in Poland, he had some contacts there, and he was planning to go and stay there for a couple of weeks, and Prabhupada was encouraging him, so he linked him up with Harry Kesh. So that was March of 76. So then a year later, Prabhupada was in Bhubaneswar. And he had just received another report from Harry Kesh. So Prabhupada was talking in the morning about another of Harry Kesh's reports, how everything is going very nicely in Eastern Europe. He's reported that they're having successes in many countries, such as Poland, Romania, etc. People in these places are very agitated due to not having sufficient foodstuffs. And in Russia, he said subversive activities are going on with subways being blown up, etc. Because in those days, you never heard any news from Russia. But that's actually what was going on. There was a lot of, you know, terrorism and underground activity going on. So Prabhupada commented. He said, yes, the human intellect cannot be artificially suppressed for very long. These things, no food, no rain, heavy taxation, so they will be punished in this way. He was very pleased to hear the report, and he stressed on the chanting and prasadam distribution as the main program, and the philosophy, he said, could come a little later. So there was one other incident that happened in mid-year in 76. We had gone to Washington, D.C., and it was the 200th anniversary, if you remember, 1976, 200 years of American independence. So the devotees had invited Prabhupada to be in the capital, you know, for July 4th. So on July 4th afternoon, the devotees told Prabhupada that they're having this big, you know, thing in the mall there in Washington. About a million people were expected, and they were going to have this huge fireworks display. So they asked Prabhupada, would you like to go for a drive, you know, around the city and see all the people? So Prabhupada said, all right, let's go. So we got in like a convoy. There was about 7 or 8 vehicles. And as we were going along, because we were up in Potomac, and that's kind of up in the hills, and then there was this winding road going down into Washington. So all along the route, people had stopped and were parked the cars, and they were kind of camping out, hoping that they would see the fireworks display, you know, from the hills without actually having to go into the city and get caught in all the traffic. So as we were going down, I had remembered that Adi Keshava had just sent a report how they'd gotten this flatbed truck, like a tray on the back with no sides, and they were putting a Sankirtan party on the back of the truck and just driving around New York all day doing kirtan on the back of this truck, and that people were really loving it. So I mentioned that to Prabhupada, that there's all these people here. It would be nice if we had a kirtan. So Prabhupada immediately told the devotees, you know, there was a van in front with about a dozen devotees. So he message was passed that Prabhupada wants you to do kirtan. So we did kirtan all the way down, you know, the road there. Because the traffic was moving very slowly. And as we went down, people heard the kirtan, and of course it was a festival, so everybody was in a good mood. So people, you know, waving and Hare Krishna, and some people were, you know, doing a little jig and like that. So it's very nice. Prabhupada was sitting there and watching. He liked it very much. So when we went down into the city, you know, all the streets were covered with people walking here and there and everywhere. And at one point we saw a bunch of young men. They had six packs of beer on their, you know, on their shoulders, and they had cans in their hands. They were all drunk, and they saw us in the car, and they came over, Hare Krishna, like this. They're all drunk. Prabhupada was laughing like anything. And then he made an unusual comment. He said, just see, he said, people naturally want to chant and dance. He said, but artificially they are suppressing. He said, and so far I have observed, he said, the people in Russia, the communist people, are not different from any other people anywhere in the world. He said, they will not be able to suppress them for long. So it was interesting. He just made this, he thought about the, you know, his visit to Russia and, you know, people's tendency. They want to chant and dance, but they're being artificially suppressed. And he said, they can't do that for long. So that was another, you know, reference there to this communist condition. So Prabhupada was always encouraging them, chant, and everything else will come from that. Okay, so it's 9 o'clock. There's a lot more stuff here, but unfortunately we don't have any time to talk about it. Does anybody have any questions or final comments? Yes, Prabhupada. Yeah, Lord Chaitanya used to chant on his fingers. Not directly to me, but when Lord Chaitanya was going on tour, he used to chant on his fingers. He would keep counting, chant like that. You know, as Prabhupada said, you have to keep numerical strength. Because chanting on beads is the best way to do that. That engages your sense of touch. And you're touching Tulsi Devi, so that's purifying as well. But if some circumstances arise, you can't do that, then you have to still chant. Again, you know, the Russians, when they started arresting our devotees there in the 80s and putting them in jail, they were taking bread and they were making beads from the bread. They were wetting it and then rolling it up, and they made strings of beads from the bread, and they were chanting on these bread japa beads. So, and I remember going, we were put, a few of us, we had problems in Sydney and Melbourne in the early days. And sometimes the devotees would, you know, we'd get booked for obstructing the traffic or soliciting or something. And then later on, the case would go to court, we would get fined, we wouldn't go there. And then after that, then they would track us down, and anybody that had a, you know, a lot of fines, they would try to arrest us and put us in jail. And sometimes they caught us, sometimes they didn't. But I remember being put in the St. Kilda watch house for a couple of days. And what we used to do, because they'd take all our beads and everything off us, they won't allow that in the jail. So what we used to do was we ripped strips off the sheets in the jail, and then made knots in them, and we used those as japa beads. You have to do what you can, whatever the circumstances. Yes, Prabhu. Did he ask me? No, Prabhupada never said anything. He could see whether we were chanting or not. He was strict about his party going to Mangalarti. He didn't like it if, you know, we didn't go. I was the only one, the servant was the only one that was allowed to not go to Mangalarti, because Prabhupada had to have somebody there with him. But everybody else, you know, the secretary and maybe Prajumna, if he was there, you know, Prabhupada was very insistent that they had to go to Mangalarti and, you know, attend the whole morning program. Yes. There was one incident with Prajumna. We had gone to Hyderabad, and there was this South Indian Brahmana, Sampat Kumar Bhattacharya, very well known in the South. He died a number of years ago. But Prabhupada, he had come to install our deities and do the opening ceremonies for our Hyderabad temple. That was on Janmashtami 76. And Prabhupada had gone down there for that opening. They were very nice people. There was like a whole group of them that came. Real, you know, the epitome of the South Indian Brahmins, you know, with the big, huge seekers, big, fat gold earrings, you know, huge tilak, big bellies, you know, fancy silk cloth. Very nice people they were. And so when they took their leave, they came to see Srila Prabhupada in his room, and Sampat Kumar gave Srila Prabhupada a Shalagram Shila. So Prabhupada immediately called Prajumna, and he said, now you take this Shalagram and you can worship. So that, you know, in those days we had no Shalagram Shilas in any temples practically. It was a very rare thing. But he gave to Prajumna and he told him, you can do it very simply. He said, just as my father, he was just bathing with Ganges water and offering some tulsi leaves. That's all. He said, the whole thing, half an hour, finished. And he said, and if, you know, for some reason you can't do, then your wife can do. So he said, husband and wife like that. So then we left Hyderabad and we went up to Delhi, and there was a pandal on Radhastami. So we were there for that. And then in the morning, Prabhupada was receiving Guru Pooj and Prajumna wasn't there. So then Prabhupada asked, right in the middle of the Guru Puja, he said, where is Prajumna? So I said, well, he's off doing his puja for his Shalagram Shila. Prabhupada said, first Guru Puja, then other puja. He said, go and tell the nonsense. First Guru Puja. So he was very heavy about it. So I had to go and, you know, bring him in. So Prabhupada used to keep tabs on us now and again. But as far as chanting, like I say, with Nanda Kumar, Prabhupada was informed that Nanda wasn't chanting, and he didn't say anything. He said, if he's already initiated Brahman, if he doesn't know how to chant his rounds now, then what can I say? So I guess maybe it's an individual thing as well, but it's not like Prabhupada was on top of us all the time. He expected us to take responsibility, and if you couldn't do that, then you had to, you know, that was your lookout. Right. Yes. Part 6. I'm working on that right now. I've done the first chapter, which is Prabhupada spent about 10 or 12 days at the Hyderabad farm in December of 76. So that the next volume will cover Hyderabad. There was a visit to a place called Wardha, which was the place where Gandhi used to have his main headquarters. Then Bombay, there was a hill station that we went to for a day or two. There was Kumbh Mela. Were you there for that, Kritta? 77? All right. You missed that. So we were at the Kumbh Mela for 4 or 5 days in Allahabad. And then from there we went by train to Calcutta and then down to Bhubaneswar and Jagannath Puri, and then we ended up in Mayapur. So this next volume, that will cover up until we arrive in Bhubaneswar, and then there will be one more volume after that to finish the series. So it's just now coming. Hare Krishna. Yes, Prabhu. Say that again, the first bit. Yeah. The law of karma in what respect? In what respect? If you're chanting, what has that got to do with your karma? Chanting doesn't have anything to do with your karma. You can chant under any circumstances. Prabhupada made that very clear. Otherwise, what is your karma? Your karma is you're going to die. If you have difficulty chanting your rounds just because of some work obligations or family obligations, then how much more are you going to be inconvenienced when you have to die? Yeah, your whole body stops working. I was with Vishvambha. He was former president of New Mayapur in France. He's a French-Canadian. So in the 1990s, he came on the Braj Mandala Parikrama. And on the last week, it's like a month, on the last week he got malaria, but he got cerebral malaria. And generally that kills you. It's very severe. If you don't catch it within the first 36 hours, generally you're dead. It's very heavy. So he got cerebral malaria. And before they, you know, realized what it was, he was already, you know, down. So they rushed him to hospital in Delhi. They put him in this horrible state hospital to start with. And the doctor gave him 10% chance. But somehow or another, he pulled through. So, thank you. Later on, he came back to Vrindavan when he'd recovered, and I was talking to him, and I was kind of interested, you know, what is it like to be near death? And he told me, he said, when the disease was at its peak, he said, my whole body was just burning. My brain was burning, my body was burning, and nothing would work. All my senses stopped. I couldn't do anything, and my brain stopped working also. So everything, his whole body was finished. And he said then, he said, you know, it was like, initially it was very severe. And, you know, he was in a lot of pain and everything. But he said, I just, somehow or another, I found this little area in my consciousness where I could rise above it. And I just took shelter in there, you know, and chanted. So he said, initially it was hard to kind of keep myself in that spot. But he said, after some time, I got practice, and then I was able to keep, you know, keep myself aloof from the whole thing, from my body and my mind and everything else. And he said, what I realized was that whatever degree of Krishna consciousness that I'd managed to develop so far, I was able to get back to that limit, but not more. So he said, now I understand. He said, you have to be very serious at every moment to always be trying to increase your Krishna consciousness. Because when death actually comes, then what you've got, you've got. Yeah. So you have to keep on pushing and trying more and more. So he got that little bit of shelter, you know, at the time of death, almost at the time of death. So you can say, oh, it's my karma, I'm too busy. But you can't tell Krishna that. Krishna knows you've got your karma. But if you try to chant Hare Krishna, he'll relieve you of your karma so that you can do it more if you're sincere. So karma doesn't have anything to do with the process of chanting. Chanting is your communication and relationship with Krishna. And if you're really serious about your relationship, you'll always chant. And you won't allow anything to get in the way of that. All right. Any other questions?
I just wanted to know, yeah. Krishna mentioned anything about, besides the chanting and the regulation, anything about the devotees' behavior. So oftentimes we see the devotees having a good sadhana, but then the behavior is not consistent with the practice. The qualities don't develop. You have kind, compassion, understanding, and encouraging. So did he refer to any of that at any time?
Well, I'm sure he did. Very often. I mean, Prabhupada's disciples were not exactly the most cultured, you know, personalities, many of us. We came from very rough backgrounds. But Prabhupada kind of tended to ignore that as long as we were sincere. I'll give you a practical example. Before I joined Prabhupada's party, I was the temple commander in Vrindavan. And Prabhupada came, Brahmananda was the secretary, Arikesh was on the party, Upendra and Nittai. So he came for 3 weeks during Janmashtami up to Radhashtami. So during that period, I had gone into the temple room one morning, and there was an old man there, and he was sitting and eating in front of the deities. So I'd read in Nectar of Devotion, or somewhere I kind of remembered, you're not supposed to eat directly in front of the deities. So I went up to him and I told him, hey, you can't do that here. You have to, you know, go outside and eat there and then you can come back in. And I thought, you know, he would say, okay, and go. But he didn't. He was really obstinate. And he said, no, I'm not going. You can't throw me out. I'm staying here and this and that. I said, look, you have to go, you know. You can't eat in front of the deities. It's offensive. So he was arguing. So at one point he said, I want to see whoever's in charge. So I said, well, I'm the temple commander and I'm in charge and you're going out. So I got him to the back. Then there was this young Bengali fellow. He was maybe about, he was the same age as me, about 25. And he had long, long hair down here. He wasn't a devotee, but he had some contact with devotees. And he happened to be in the temple. He had a French girlfriend, you know, quite good looking. So he was kind of like full of himself, you know. He had his long hair and his white girlfriend, and you know, like that. And he's a Bengali also, so he's a little, you know, extreme. So he came over. He saw what was happening. And he started getting into me like anything. Who the hell do you think you are? This is Krishna's temple. You can't stop anybody from coming in like this. He was getting right into me. So I just, okay. So I just, you know, backed off. He cooled down. He kind of wandered off. And then the old man had kind of gone to the back. And then I looked around again and the old guy comes back right in and starts eating again. So I thought, no way, I'm going to have this, you know. So I went over and I told him, look, I said, I already asked you. Now, just go out the door, eat, wash, and then come back in. So I was kind of getting him out the door. And we just got out the main doors there and the Bengali boy was there. So he just flipped. He completely lost it. So he came over and he was screaming and yelling at the top of his voice. He was swearing at me. And at one point he grabbed hold of me, grabbed my arm. And, you know, I had to kind of break his grip and prise it off. And he was telling me, I'm going to cut your bloody seeker off. You know, I'll get you when you come outside the gate like this. He was really, really, you know, raving. He'd lost it. Sometimes in India you get situations where people start rioting and stuff, and they actually go mad. They just lose it. You can see it in their eyes. They're just nothing there anymore. You know, they're just crackers. So he was, you know, he was getting to that point. So I thought, I better just, you know, walk away from this, you know. So I started to walk away, and I was thinking, if I walk away, then he'll calm down and he'll go away. But he didn't. He kept on yelling and screaming and abusing me. So I got about 10 steps. And then my false ego took over. And I thought, right, that's it. You're out. So I went back and I just told him, I said, you say one more word and you're out. So he just kept on, you know, he wasn't listening. He just kept on screaming at me. So then that was it. I leaned back and bopped him one. So I split his lip. And, you know, he was in such a state of shock, he stopped. And he had, you know, there was blood coming from his mouth and everything. And then I twisted his arm up his back and grabbed him by his long hair. And I had the chaukidar throw him out. So some of the devotees were watching. They were kind of like aghast. What's this guy doing? I'd only been in India a couple of months. And in Australia, we'd had a couple of incidences where we'd been attacked and we actually had to fight. So, you know, it was a modus operandi. And from where I came from an iron and steel town in northern England. And we used to go out on a Saturday night, you know, with jeans and leather jackets and steel toe cap boots and stuff and get in fights. That's what we used to do. So, you know, that was my mode. Now I became a devotee, but, you know, it's kind of hard to shake off the conditioning. So anyway, I had this altercation with this boy in Vrindavan. So I'm up in my room in the afternoon, and somebody comes banging on the door, Harry Sawyer, Prabhupada wants to see you. And I, you know, Prabhupada had never called for me, ever. He didn't even know my name. He knew me by sight from Australia, but I knew immediately, oh no, I know what this is about, you know. So I was kind of like really apprehensive. And then I went into Prabhupada's room, and sure enough, Prabhupada was sitting there. He was very grave. He wasn't angry, but he was just really, really grave. And I was just like totally morose. I was just thinking, this is the first time I've ever been called for by my spiritual master, and it's always something like this, you know. So then Prabhupada asked me what had happened. So I just, you know, faithfully related the whole story, every detail. Prabhupada listened. When he got to the point where I told him about, you know, the temple commander, and, you know, I'm the temple commander, so I'm in charge, Prabhupada stopped me and he said, temple commander does not mean commander in chief. Then he let me continue. So he heard it and he understood there was, you know, there was provocation. You know, the boy had, you know, basically brought it on himself to some degree. But at the end of it, he said, you have committed a great offense. He said, now previously we had so many problems. There'd been a riot a couple of years before at Casey Gap Palace. I didn't know anything about this. But, you know, the Western devotees initially, you know, they were greeted with suspicion and a lot of animosity when we first moved into Vrindavan. So Prabhupada said, now he's going to go into the bazaar and he'll tell all the people, the local people, that these Westerners have beaten him up. And then there'll be so many problems. So he said, now you go and find him and apologize and bring him back to the temple. And then he sent me out. So then I was just like, you know, what am I going to do? I had no idea where he was staying or how to find him or anything. And it was too late that afternoon. So the next morning I took a rickshaw. I'd heard that he was staying at the Bila Mandir at Mathura. So I took a rickshaw all the way out there. And I asked around. Nobody had heard of the guy. And then I came back. So I was up in my room and I was completely morose. I was just lying on my bed and I was just thinking, oh, you know, Prabhupada told me to do this and I can't do it. And then there's a knock on the door. Prabhupada wants to see you. And I thought, oh no. Now I'm going to have to go and tell him that I couldn't do it. So when I went into Prabhupada's room, it was about 4 p.m. and it was packed. He was having a darshan and the place was full up. So Prabhupada saw me at the back. He said, call me up. So I went up, I offered my obeisances, and I was in such a state of trepidation that Prabhupada started speaking to me and I couldn't understand a single word he said. He said something and I was really trying and I just couldn't make out a single word. So Prabhupada stopped and he looked at me and I've got this blank look on my face. And, you know, Prabhupada's getting a bit frustrated. And I said, I'm sorry, I couldn't understand what you said. So he repeated it. And the second time, I was trying like anything. And I still couldn't understand, not a single word. I don't know what happened. But I just couldn't understand it. So Prabhupada got so frustrated, he turned to another devotee. He was an older man, Pranab Mukherjee. And he said, you tell him. So then he explains to me, he said, that boy that you got in a fight with yesterday, he's here. And then all of a sudden I hear this from the middle of the room behind me. Oh, Prabhu, I'm so sorry. Like this. This boy's in the darshan. And he'd come back on his own. And he had gone to Prabhupada and apologized. Right? And then he was sitting in the darshan. So he was very emotional. And he said, oh, I'm so sorry. After you hit me yesterday, I realized I was wrong. And, you know, all this stuff like this. So somebody had given Prabhupada some fruit. And it was underneath his table. So he said, now take this fruit, give him some. And then, you know, make it up. So we went into the other room. And, you know, it was all settled up. But that was my first real, you know, exchange with Srila Prabhupada. And yet 2 months later, he made me his servant. And, you know, when he came to Delhi, he had no servant, and I just happened to be there for the day. And because of that incident, and because Hari Kesh had seen me in action as the temple commander in Vrindavan, when Prabhupada discussed with Hari Kesh about who was going to be his, you know, who was going to do his massage and be his servant, then, you know, Hari Kesh was, you know, Prabhupada had seen me at the door as the door guard. And he said, well, what about that Australian boy? And Hari Kesh said, oh, no, I don't think he would be suitable at all, you know, and this and that. And Prabhupada said, no, he's here, so let him try. And that's how I got on the party. So Prabhupada didn't hold it against us, you know, that we sometimes did the wrong thing or our behavior was not very good. He wanted to see the sincerity and whether we were willing to try to correct it. That's what he looked for. Yeah, otherwise, you know, he had to deal with so many eccentric characters. You know, Hansa Duda, Guru Kripa, these are really heavy guys. Garga Muni, you know, nobody could deal with them, but Prabhupada could. And he got tremendous service out of all of us, despite the fact that we were, you know, highly unqualified in every respect. I couldn't hear you, sorry. Yeah, well, you know, Prabhupada was just very expert, and he was looking for the spiritual principle. He knew, you know, we had so many, I mean, we weren't trained. We were from Malecha backgrounds. How could we be trained? But his mission was to bring us up to the Vaishnava platform. And he knew that means, you know, it's like dealing with kids. They do so many things. You have to be very patient, give them instruction, guidance, and let them grow up. And eventually, you know, gradually they actually become what you would like them to be. So Prabhupada knew that. He had a broader vision of things. Prabhupada said, just rely on the chanting, that's all. He said, if you just chant Hare Krishna come what may, eventually everything, just like I gave the example of Dayoji Punja. You know, he was chanting, but he was selling meat and liquor in his shop. And Prabhupada said, that's all right, just let him be. He's chanting, everything will be all right. And it did. After a couple of months, he gave it up because he was chanting. All right, I think we're going to get the boot now. So thank you all for coming. This is the last session, so if anybody is interested, all of the different anecdotes that I've included here, they're all from the volumes of Transcendental Diary. There's 5 volumes. I think they're selling it in the store here. So if anybody's interested to get that, otherwise you can order it from the archives. They have a stock of all the volumes there. So, thank you. Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai.